This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, July 19th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, the seafood industry in the Gulf of Mexico faces challenges getting compensation from the BP oil spill. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton continues bilateral talks with Pakistan.
Our partnership with Pakistan goes far beyond security. It is economic, political, educational, cultural, historical.
And we'll go to the Afghanistan-Pakistan border to follow young students as they make their way across a sometimes dangerous crossing to go to school. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Some 20,000 HIV experts and advocates are in Vienna today, where a week-long international conference on AIDS is underway. AIDS 2010 Chair Julio Montaner said yesterday that G8 nations have not kept up with promises to fund universal access to treatment programs and warned that dire consequences could result. A study led by Montaner and published in yesterday's Lancet found a direct correlation between increased HIV treatment and decreased transmission. And another study, to be released by the CDC at the conference, finds that in the United States, poverty, not race, is the most common denominator in urban transmission rates. When five African-American police officers in Washington, D.C. complained about racial discrimination, their boss retaliated. A jury has now ruled in their favor. Tanya Snyder reports.
A jury has found that commanding officer Ronald Wilkins punished the five officers for filing a racial discrimination complaint. The complaint was anonymous, but according to the Washington Examiner, Wilkins figured out who it was and started withholding information the officers needed to do their jobs. When they took the next step in the complaint, all five officers were taken out of the elite unit they worked in and demoted. Chris Bauman is the head of D.C.'s police union.
That is unfortunately sort of standard procedure right now within this police department. The officials in the department, particularly the high-ranking officials, simply don't understand how the law and rules are supposed to work, and frankly, I don't think they care.
Despite a department reprimand for dereliction of duty and lying to investigators, Lieutenant Wilkins has since been promoted. The city now has to pay $900,000 to be divided among the five officers. A police spokeswoman says the department will appeal the decision. Tanya Snyder, FSRN, Washington.
An ex-Guantanamo Bay detainee says British Secret Service accounts of his interrogations are wrong. He's one of six former detainees suing the British government for its role in their secret rendition. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
These highly classified documents were released through the High Court as part of the ongoing case against the government and the security services. Omar Deghaze, one of those six men, says the notes the government has given the court are incomplete because they show only one record of an interview with UK agents in Guantanamo. Deghaze claims there were three or four meetings. He also says the notes leave out all the specific complaints he made about ill treatment, starvation and beatings. He says one attack by a prison guard was so brutal he was left blind in one eye. The British government has always denied involvement in so-called extraordinary rendition and torture of terrorism suspects, but these documents suggest direct involvement. Mr. Deghaze's allegations increase the pressure on the government to appoint an independent judge to decide whether the notes have been legitimately blacked out. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
Irish President Mary McAleese signed a civil union measure into law today. The civil partnership bill will allow unmarried domestic partners, both gay and straight, to register and receive marriage-like legal rights. The measure will not take effect until after updates are made to the nation's tax and public assistance laws, most likely early next year. In Gaza, Hamas has banned women from publicly smoking water pipes. Rami Al-Maghari has more.
Hamas authorities say that the ban is meant to preserve the social and religious values of Gaza conservative community. Gaza's 1.6 million residents have been locked down inside the Gaza Strip for 3 years, with severe restrictions on the movement of people and goods alike. Across Gaza, particularly at seaside resorts and big coffee shops, men and women enjoy smoking a water pipe as a deviation from the restrictions created by the Israeli blockade. Riham Al-Halabi, who wears a head covering, is a university graduate. She was socializing with some friends at the Delisa store, one of the major coffee shops in Gaza City.
This decision contradicts our entire society, where women or girls may have their own personal motives or reasons. Yet it seems that this decision is binding. Therefore, we will witness more repression of women's freedoms.
The water pipe ban for women is the latest in a string of restrictions imposed over the past 3 years. For example, females are not allowed to ride on motorbikes and should wear special uniforms at schools. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
In Iraq today, bombs continue to kill. 4 are dead in Bakuba, 1 in Mosul. Yesterday, 3 separate bombings killed as many as 51 people, most of whom were members of the Awakening Council, a U.S.-funded group that turned on al-Qaeda in Iraq. The Awakening Council was established as a U.S.-sponsored alternative to insurgency. In 2008, Iraqi officials took over responsibility for the council, but many promised civilian jobs have yet to materialize, and they say they are often paid late when they're paid at all. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. BP continues to monitor pressure levels on the capped oil well in the Gulf of Mexico. Yesterday, the oil company and the U.S. government announced that they had found a leak in the seafloor near the capped well, causing concern that pressure levels in the well are getting too high. If the leak gets worse, BP may have to uncap the well and allow oil to continue flowing into the Gulf of Mexico. As the company continues to wrestle with the gusher, BP and the U.S. government are encouraging business owners to apply for disaster compensation from BP's $20 billion relief fund. But some in the hard-hit Gulf seafood industry say funding is hard to apply for and often adds up to too little. FSRN's Matt Pearson reports.
Seepage from the sea floor could be a serious setback for operations to control BP's damaged oil well. If leaking worsens, BP would have to resume allowing oil to gush into surface containment zones, where it can then be collected by tankers or burned off. More than 825 barrels of oil were contained before the well was sealed off last Thursday. An estimated 2 million barrels has spilled into the Gulf of Mexico. Chief of Recovery Efforts, retired Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen, says his team is monitoring the well closely in case the leak worsens and the well cap needs to be removed.
BP and our scientific team are working on this thing, and we agreed that we would take a bunch of readings on the bottom through seismic, acoustic, hydrophones, and so forth, and assiduously look for leaks while we continue to evaluate it, because there is some benefit to having the well shut in and not having oil released into the environment. But as you stated, the real end of this thing will be when we do the bottom kill, or we actually intercept the well and we start to plug that, which could happen as early as late next week into early August, as you indicated.
The successful capping of the well was a sign of hope for Gulf businesses that have been hurting since the April 20th spill. Until business recovers, many must apply for emergency and long-term compensation funds from BP. But that's not always easy. Additionally, Gulf Coast residents and businesses who accept BP claims funds are then prohibited from ever pursuing legal action against the company. Ken Feinberg was appointed by President Obama to oversee BP's $20 billion oil spill compensation fund. Feinberg also operated emergency relief funds after the 9/11 bombings and Hurricane Katrina.
I mean, who wouldn't come into this program? It is, to my way of thinking, an easy call.
Feinberg, who spoke Monday morning at the Economic Club in D.C., strongly encouraged Gulf residents to take the claims rather than pursuing legal avenues.
Anybody can decide, I want nothing to do with this. I'd rather go to court or implement my other legal rights. Go ahead. You're crazy to do so, though. Go ahead if you want. Because under this program, you will receive, if you're eligible, you will receive compensation without having to go to court for years, without the uncertainty of going to court, since I'll be much more generous than any court would be.
But some Gulf businesses aren't as enthusiastic about the relief funds. Oyster fishers are one group that needs the funds badly. They have been hit hard by the spill and its fallout. Fishers say prime oyster harvest is down 30% from this time last year. Some say it's even worse. Vicente Cardenas operates two oyster vessels out of Gray, Louisiana. On a good week before the spill, he brought in 700 to 800 sacks of oysters per week. Now his boats are tied up at the docks. He says the money he gets from BP isn't enough.
Well, they was giving $5,000 a month, but I mean that ain't nothing. $5,000 is it ain't nothing. No, to compare what we was making is nothing.
Vicente's wife keeps his books in order, so he was able to provide proof of losses in order to receive funds. But he says the workers on his boat lost their emergency relief funds because they didn't have the proper tax and earning information. Providing enough proof of losses is a problem for many fishermen, even those who have paid their taxes, because many of them operate in cash only. But Ken Feinberg says he can only do so much without proof.
I mean, I cannot just pay claims. You've got to prove your claim. I can be very lenient as to the proof. There's nothing illegal about a cash business, but I've got to have proof.
Larger businesses, whose losses from the spill are only a portion of their overall revenue, will take longer to process than fishermen like Vicente. Feinberg says he plans to give out the recovery funds over the next 3 years. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
According to a 2-year investigation by the Washington Post, since the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the U.S. government has created an expansive top-secret network of intelligence and anti-terrorism agencies that is hidden from public view and lacks thorough oversight. The investigation finds that nearly 2,000 private companies and some 1,200 government agencies operate in 10,000 locations across the country, often in secrecy. Many of the agencies produce the same work, creating waste and redundancy. The Post reports that agencies produce 50,000 intelligence reports every year, many of which are routinely ignored in a system that lacks synchronization. In an online video, reporters Dana Priest and William Arkin describe how massive funding and a lack of regulation has led to an unwieldy system.
This is a closed community, and since 9/11, it's become even more so.
The money spigot was just opened after 9/11, and nobody dared say, I don't think we should be spending that much.
It has become so big, and the lines of responsibility are so blurred that even our nation's leaders don't have a handle on it. Where is it? It's being built from coast to coast, hidden within some of America's most familiar cities and neighborhoods.
The investigation, Top Secret America, was published in today's Washington Post. It includes a public online database of government and private companies involved with the network. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton finishes a 2-day-long trip to Pakistan today, where she continues ministerial-level strategic talks. Today she promoted $500 million in aid money to go to dams, energy production, hospitals, and agricultural development. It's part of more than $7 billion in aid approved by Congress last year and to be spread out over 5 years. Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi.
We are focusing on projects, on sectors that would make a qualitative difference to the lives of ordinary Pakistanis. So they understand that this relationship is beyond security. This is a relationship that improves our purchasing power, our quality of life.
Clinton also emphasized that the partnership is not just about military aid and security.
Our partnership with Pakistan goes far beyond security. It is economic, political, educational, cultural, historical, rooted in family ties. That this misperception has persisted for so long tells us we have not done a good enough job of connecting our partnership with concrete improvements in the lives of Pakistanis. And with this dialogue, we are working very hard to change that perception and to deliver results that truly have the concrete effects we are seeking.
Pakistan is key in the U.S. bid to oust militants and terrorists from the region, but many civilians blame the U.S. government for fomenting violence through CIA unmanned drone strikes in the country, which have killed many civilians. In another regional development, Pakistan and Afghanistan announced a new trade deal on Sunday. The deal needs to be approved by both countries' governments. It would allow Afghanistan to move goods through Pakistan into India and for Pakistan to move goods across Afghanistan to Central Asia. U.S. officials praised the deal. They say it will help Afghan President Karzai fight the insurgency. The Pakistan-Afghan border is a strategic location for the U.S. government, and today we're going to take you there, to the Hindu Kush mountain range and a place called Torkham Gate. It's the main border crossing, and hundreds of U.S. military and NATO trucks cross there every day. Thousands of travelers also pass through Torkham Gate, including many Afghan students who cross into Pakistan 6 days a week to study in private schools. But even though most people traveling through the gate face no problems crossing, these young people do. FSRN's Antonio Ortiz reads for our reporter in Pakistan, Gabe Matthews.
Before the Torkham border gate opens in the morning, travelers from both Pakistan and Afghanistan line up and wait to cross the border. Although there used to be a physical gate here, now it's just a tightly knotted rope, and when officials finally untie it, men, women, and children will rush to cross the other side. One of those in line is 15-year-old Barakat Khan. Khan lives in Afghanistan, but makes this journey nearly every day so he can go to school. He also has a disability. Polio hit his left hand and right leg when he was only 2 years old.
I've gone to school in Pakistan since the first grade because there are no good schools in my village. And now for eighth grade, I'm planning to go to Kabul because there are good schools in Kabul.
Khan says his father is a shopkeeper who can't afford school fees for him or his brothers. But his father urges him to study in Pakistan because he'll get a better education here.
He wants me to study so that I can work in an office because without an education, I wouldn't be able to do anything respectable for a living. I work hard and get the third or fourth highest scores on exams.
Like other Afghan students who have to cross the border to get to school, Khan usually arrives late. He misses the first assembly and singing the school anthem, whose lyrics include, "We would like to make our country more peaceful and beautiful with our efforts. We must unite to bring prosperity to our country." About 700 students study at the Pak Afghan Public School, and about 70% are Afghan. Every day before starting their studies, the students shout, "Long live Pak Afghan friendship." The principal started this routine for two reasons. To appease Afghan students because the school's curriculum does not include Afghanistan history, culture, or politics. And also to encourage good relations between the students, especially when they regularly witness tensions between Afghan and Pakistani border guards when they cross Torkham Gate. Ninth grade student Imran Khan comes late to school too, because he works as a porter to pay for school. He's often stopped at the border.
I belong to a poor family, and my father and brother are also porters here in Torkham. I started as porter as soon as I started school here. I work after school gets out, except for Fridays. I earn 50 cents and sometimes $1 per day. I came here only because there is no good institution and school in my village. There are good subjects here to study, and while back in my village, we have only Pashto and Dari to read. I want to help my people and save them from trouble.
It's a break period for students, but during this leisure time, only the boys are allowed to play games outside. The female students must stay in the classroom during break, where they eat lunch, usually bread and an onion they bring from home. There are only 15 female students in the school. Five of them are from Afghanistan and walk 90 minutes each day to get to the Pak Afghan Public School. They also face restrictions during class. For example, they cannot ask questions as boldly as the boys do. Principal Abdul Razik says even with these restrictions, they risk attack because of the co-education.
The present circumstances are not favorable to girls' education. Anyone can blow up a school anytime. Recently, many girls' schools have been blown up. Therefore, I am afraid too, and I cannot take the risk of allowing girls past grade 2. Personally, I also do not like co-education.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, J, K, L.
In grades 1 and 2, there are co-ed classes, but boys and girls are separated by sex in their seating assignments. 7-year-old Rashmina is in one of these classes. She is shy and self-conscious, making sure to stand far away from the boys to conduct an interview.
My father is poor and cannot afford my school fee. I am very good in my studies because my teachers teach us in a better way than before. I want to be a teacher someday. Besides my studies, I sweep my room, wash dishes, bring wood from the mountains, and bring water from far away. I also work in a neighbor's house. If I were rich, I would study in Peshawar and would become a doctor. Then my parents would definitely have no objection to my education.
Not all the Afghan students make it to class. Back at Torkham Gate, 10-year-old Askar Khan carries luggage in his handcart. He is in his school uniform.
I did not go to school today because my teacher asked me for my monthly school fee and I didn't have the money to pay the fee. So I came to work as a porter today to earn my fee. My father is old and cannot afford my fee. The border force personnel stopped me and made me wait for a long time.
He carries cloths and hammers in his handcart along with an Afghan passenger. The security guard has prevented Khan from crossing the border for the last couple of hours. The security guard shouts at Khan to turn back and stay behind the gate. He takes Khan's luggage and openly demands a bribe. He warns Khan he won't be able to cross if he doesn't pay him money.
Now they stop me and they don't allow me to cross the border. I will not be able to earn money this time. Sometimes they beat me when I bring luggage. They beat me, not once, but several times. Now I won't be able to get the luggage back unless I pay the bribe. The security personnel may demand $4, $5, or $5.5 US for luggage.
Next to Askar Khan is 8-year-old Shafi Ullah Khan, who carries a small sack of shampoos and soap on his back.
I'm a second grade student in the Pak Afghan school. I did not go to school today because I did not have the fee to pay. I have shampoo packets and I may get 5 or 10 rupees per packet. I will earn my fee till 1 o'clock in the afternoon and then I will go home.
He is the next target of the security personnel. Despite all these hardships, Afghan students interviewed by FSRN say they will continue their education in Pakistan schools until the Afghan government improves its education system. The students say they want to see science and English added to the curriculum in Afghanistan. Reading for Gabe Matthews on the Pak-Afghan border, I'm Antonio Ortiz for FSRN.
On July 15th, former defense lawyer Lynn Stewart was resentenced to 10 years in prison by a federal judge in New York. In 2005, Stewart was convicted of aiding terrorism. Her sentencing stems from a violation of the special administrative measures, which govern what information can be made public, during her representation of Omar Abdel Rahman, the Egyptian cleric who was convicted in 1995 on terrorism charges. The sentencing could have broad implications for defense attorneys. For more on the case, we're joined by David Gaspas, president of the National Lawyers Guild. Welcome to FSRN.
Oh, thank you for having me.
First, let's go into the details of Lynn Stewart's original conviction. It comes from her violation of these special administrative measures, rules that began to be applied more vigorously after the September 11th attacks. What are these special administrative measures, or SAMs, and how do they apply to her case?
Her client was Sheikh Abdul Rahman, who had been convicted of the earlier Trade Towers bombing. And the administrative measures basically limited her contact with her client to only speaking about issues relating to his case and not anything else about what was going on in the world. Which was particularly difficult for a blind sheikh in a U.S. prison who did not speak English, and required that she sign an agreement that she not do that and also not communicate anything that he said to her outside of the attorney-client relationship and whatever may be needed in court.
One of the criticisms of this case is that Lynn Stewart was operating in the 2000 and 2001 year at a time when these new rules were being put into effect. It wasn't entirely clear how they were going to be enforced or what was permitted and what wasn't. Now, today in 2010, are these special administrative measures in place now, and what is their effect on defense lawyers today?
They are in place in particular cases now, for sure. And I think that the effect on criminal defense lawyers who have them is that they are going to be even more reluctant to discuss anything with their clients. One of the things that is really, really disturbing is that Lynn's communications with her client were listened to and recorded by the government. And a lawyer simply cannot represent any client, much less someone accused of serious criminal charges, unless they are assured of confidentiality.
Well, talk about that for a moment, because these are what you're referring to, are these conversations between Attorney Stewart and her client that took place over the course of, what is it, 2 years? This is the client and lawyer relationship, which is supposed to be sealed. I mean, it's supposed to be not disclosed to public or prosecutors. That was an important part of her prosecution.
Yes, it was. It was critical to it. Confidentiality between a lawyer and a client is the absolute precondition to effective and responsible representation.
You mentioned Lynn Stewart's long history of representing clients who the broader society deems unpopular, of contempt. Now, much of the focus, of course, on this case is on her representation of Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, who is serving a life sentence on terrorism charges. She's also represented, though, members of the Black Panther Party, members of the Weather Underground. And now the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, the Society of Law Teachers, other groups have talked about the chilling effect this decision could have on defense attorneys, especially those who represent unpopular clients or clients who have trouble accessing adequate legal rights. What is the effect on due process, on legal representation of this kind of a sentence?
The effect is that criminal defense lawyers are going to feel significantly, I fear, restricted in their ability to act on their clients' behalf. And to anyone who is representing clients who are at all controversial, much less criminal defendants, all of whom are sort of by nature, quote, unpopular, it represents not just the thought that they may get prosecuted, but that they can get, that whatever they do is going to be subject to scrutiny by the government, and that the government is going to be seeking not just punishment, but the harshest possible punishment.
David Gespas is president of the National Lawyers Guild. He joined us to talk about Lynn Stewart, defense attorney, resentenced to 10 years in prison last week. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.